Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab, and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you so much, Audrey. Thank you once again for getting us on the Blog Talk Radio Network. And Mike, first off, I'll try to answer your question the best as I can. I don't know what type of progress that the FBI is making on that serial killer trucker task force that they've got going, where they're collecting all that data about truckers. They think that some truckers might be posing, or some serial killers might be posing as truckers and driving around the country. Good luck with that one. But John, be careful as you hitchhike those rides. You never know who you're going to be getting in the truck with. Thank you very much, Audrey, again, and welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network. I'm Keith Haley, your host, and you're on the show, the Jumble Justice Radio Show. You're listening to it. Johnny Cash did it again. He made it across again. He made it to Dayton tonight. Remember last week? He couldn't make it to Dayton. I think his truck ran out of gas. Emily and Mike, thank you for being with us tonight, and Mike, particularly, thank you for gathering us some very special news tonight and put together some of this audio business that we're going to be doing tonight with interviews. I think two very interesting interviews, and most of the people will certainly know the name Carl Bernstein of a Woodward and Bernstein fame, going back to the Watergate time. Those of you who are young have read about that particular period of time with President Nixon, et cetera, et cetera. So the purpose of our show is what it always is. We like to look at news issues, events, discuss them, talk about them, critique them, and these events are about criminal justice. And we know that we have professionals throughout the world who are tireless and work very hard in the field of police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice to keep us safe. We have a little news story, I think, from just about every segment of the system tonight. Maybe not. I've got some long articles about prison that are kind of sensitive. I probably won't get to. But we try to look inside the practice of criminal justice and take a close-up look at it as professionals. And it's been fun. We're pushing 2 years here. In about 3 months, we'll have 2 years of radio shows done on the Blog Talk Radio Network. You're listening on BTR, and Alan Levy is the CEO of that Blog Talk Radio Network, and you can see his show in the mornings if you care to do that, but just think of this. He started with a little conversational program about two summers ago, and now this they have literally thousands of radio shows, and I hope tonight, and I can't Can't believe the celebrities now that have their shows on, or people that star in these skits and these shows on television. I will also have a Blog Talk Radio show pushing and talking about something. I'm not sure what they're doing, but by next week, I think I'm going to take a little run through those shows. Audrey, you could help me with that, and we'll see how many shows there really are. It's got to be, I don't know, I'm guessing tens of thousands perhaps now. And what's the technology to keep all that going? I guess Alan Levy and his assistants would be the only ones that would know the answer to that. But any person, that's the great part of it, any interest group, any organization can have their own Blog Talk Radio show that can broadcast more than one time a week. I think you can have a show every day now. And it's absolutely free, and it's broadcast worldwide in streaming audio at no cost. Let me reiterate, at no cost to you. That's incredible. Jump back 10 years ago, 8 years ago, 5 years ago. This would have cost you big-time money. And to get the type of clarity I think that BTR has at no cost, that's just incredible. And I should say this, there are a lot of ways. There are about 3 different directions that you can go if you decide to get your own show. You can go advertising. I've chosen not to do that, and I've chosen not to go feature. I'm not trying to promote something beyond here what I'm capable of doing and what I want to do. I'm using this as a sideline, not a way to make a living. But you can make money from this, and they kick back about 50% of the revenue based on the advertising that comes off of your particular radio site. So like it says on the box of Cheez-Its, get your own box where you can get your own show here with BTR. Tonight's going to be a very special show. I have a lot of audio to play and people to listen to. It's very interesting, but having a journalist in the family, I've always been concerned about the safety and security of journalists and young journalists, as my family member did, started off working cops. That's like in the middle of the night, and she had some very interesting stories about what goes on, particularly coming home at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning in an area where she lived in central Texas, where there was a drug halfway house right across the street, and that alone was its own challenge to get in the door and beat the roaming people in the night, shall we say. But tonight we're going to talk about threats and violence against the media. We have this very recent case. It isn't even scratching the surface in terms of numbers, but certainly in terms of significance. The two women that were taken into custody in North Korea, and then they've been sentenced to a prison camp. And I don't know if you know much about North Korean prison camps, but you don't want to be there. One of their favorite methods of getting you to do what they want you to do and say is starvation, and that's not fun. But threats and violence against the media, and we're going to focus primarily on Mexico and the drug cartel and all that's going on there near the border and other places in Mexico. It's a fascinating story, and the people that are commenting are people that work there, reporters, journalists that work there. I think you'll find it very interesting. You can listen as you're doing on the Windows Media Player or on your computer, or you can actually listen on the phone. You can call in to the number 347-996-5983. You can listen, and you can call in during the news portion of the show if you want to talk about some of these news events or make a comment. You're certainly welcome to do that. After this is over, if you choose to use it for a class or your own enjoyment, you can play these things back. They're archived in about 10 minutes after the show's over. So you can go right to Blog Talk Radio, Jumble Justice site, and you can see the most recent shows and all of the others if you choose to run back about almost 2 years. Well, Audrey, I think we keep making firsts, don't we, with these blonde jokes. And ladies and gentlemen, Audrey England is a blonde. She grew up in London, England, and she's been a collector of blonde jokes since childhood, and she has the largest chest full of blonde jokes stored somewhere, probably in safekeeping, under lock and key, and she brings these jokes out and presents us one each week. So she has one tonight that we've not had anything about. She has one about a blonde applying to be a police officer. Audrey, are you set with that one? Let's go with it.
I think you and our audience will like this blonde joke tonight, Professor Haley. It is about a blonde who wants to be a police officer. Here it is. A blonde walks into the police department looking for a job. The captain says they can't just turn her away. and orders the desk officer to ask her a few questions, as if doing an interview, to just play along and humor her, not having any idea what to ask her to disqualify her application. The officer asks, "What's 2 plus 2? 4, the blonde says. "Dang," the officer thinks, so he tries a harder one. "What's the square root of 100? 10, the blonde says. "Good," the officer says, deciding to switch from math to history. "Okay, who killed Abraham Lincoln?" "I don't know," she admits. "Well, you can go home and think about it," he says, "and come back later and tell me what you've figured out." He figures that's the last he'll see of her. The blonde goes home and calls up one of her friends, who asks her if she got the job. "Not only did I get the job," the blonde says, "but I've already been assigned to a murder case."
Oh, that's a good one. Well, ladies and gentlemen, not a very good segue into our next public service announcement, but we've been proud to always present the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms public service announcement, trying to get gun thugs, street thugs, criminals to turn in their weapons. And we're going to play that again tonight, and we hope it falls on the right ears and that these criminals decide that they should be turning their guns into the police department. In fact, in some of these cities in the United States, you turn in your gun, you can get no questions asked, and you can get a little reward card. You can get $20. Who knows what they're giving away, depending on what part of the country you're in. So let's go ahead and listen to this public service announcement for the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, it certainly is, Ohio Coalition, and it's a deadly idea. And we thank you very much again for that public service announcement. And again, we always hope that it falls on the right ears. Let me start with a story. I'll go back to guns in just a moment. As you might imagine, there is always gun news in the news. But this is one that you've probably seen in some of the major news stories. I got it off of I believe the New York Times, and it's a story of the 72-year-old grandmother in Austin, Texas, and or at least around Austin, and she was out shopping or whatever she was doing, and she was driving her white pickup truck, and unfortunately, and certainly she shouldn't be doing that, she was speeding 60 miles an hour in the 45-mile per hour zone, and the 72-year-old grandmother is threatening now to sue the police in Texas after an officer tased her with a stun gun. Her name is Catherine Winkfein. She was pulled over for speeding while doing her weekly shopping in Austin. She had a pickup truck. That's what folks often do. They live out of town. They have a truck. They come in once a week, once every 2 weeks, and load that thing up and go back home. Travis County Sheriff's Deputy Chris Beasy shocked her with a taser gun after she resisted arrest and became argumentative. She was going 60 in the 45, not exactly the worst thing in the world to do, but something that shouldn't be done. If you take a look at this footage, and I think everybody here tonight is taking a look at it, it shows the officer, he shoves her, and then he points the taser gun at her as she refuses to go quietly. And he says, "If you don't step back, you're going to get tased." She says, "Go ahead, tase me," she replied. "I dare you." This may come down as famous as the "tase me, bro, don't tase me, bro" comment from the Florida student. But anyway, the video shows Mr. Beasy using the taser and Mrs. Winkfein hitting the ground and moaning in considerable pain. She's 72 years old. I don't know exactly how relevant that age is, but the officer looked fairly staunch. Like he could have handled her if it would have been necessary, but instead, of course, the police will come back and say, as I almost completely understand, that the taser in some ways is easier than handling someone and wrestling with them, if that would have been the case with her, but I don't think she's probably a championship arm wrestler or anything like that, so given his size and her size, the contrast, he probably could have handled her pretty good. So anyway, the Taser remains a controversial weapon. I think the jury's finally in on it, though, and that it's a device that probably saves, cuts down injuries, let me say, on officers and citizens, about 50% is what people are saying around the country. This is an interesting story out of Arizona, and journalist here is very clever. He says, like many of you, I can get overwhelmed by important news, by world events, the economy, all of the serious and somber stuff that we're force-fed, like the peas or broccoli we were required to clean off our plates before the dinner table. He's very very wordy, very elegant, very interesting in the way he puts this. But he talks about empty calorie news, and one of his empty calorie news stories that he's poking fun is that Senate Bill 1113, he calls it a deep-fried special from the legislative menu, get the metaphors, that just might have local restaurant owners asking patrons, would you like bullets or body armor with that? What the Senate Bill 113 does in Arizona, it allows people that have concealed carry permits for firearms, they'd be allowed to bring their weapons into restaurants that serve liquor. Now, a stipulation of the law is they can't drink. If they can take the weapon inside the restaurant. And he goes on and on. He talks about this. He says, they interview somebody, Mr. Pierce, and he says, the last thing I want to do is leave a gun in my car so that when a guy steals my car, he's armed. Of course, the journalist makes fun of that, and he says, you know, how many places do you know where somebody comes out from a restaurant and their car's missing? Well, I don't know. I've been to New Orleans. anyway, some places that could happen, but he's saying it's not very sensible to have a law like this, and he says the lobbyists who soaked the National Rifle Association for a bundle to get it passed will get a pat on their backs from their bosses for a job well done. I don't think this is objective reporting, is it? This had to be in the opinion section of the paper, but oddly enough, it wasn't in the Arizona Republic. So anyway, he thinks this is silly. I think one of the things he probably ought to take a look at, which I've done a small bit of writing about in one of my book chapters, was the case of the shooting in the Luby's cafeteria with a woman who was the, she was the, what do you call it? Yeah, chiropractor. And she went in to have a celebration dinner with her mother and father. And this crazy nut comes in and shoots up the place and kills them right in front of her. Had she had the gun, she was a trained firearms person. She had open shots that she probably could have saved their lives and the lives of others. So you never know when somebody's going to be the victim of attack. I would venture to say that 80-90% of these cases are killed on the street or killed in a restaurant or someplace like that. Sure, the chance is slim, but when it happens, why not even up the score? But they're not going to drink in this, which is good. I thought this was a very interesting story. I had it up last week, and we didn't have time to talk about it. But here's the one about the cops in New York City continuing to put tickets on a car. And the tickets on the car accumulated. First, they put three or four or whatever. And then as the tickets accumulated, they decided finally that they're going to tow the car away. A New York City woman said her father apparently lay dead for weeks in a minivan while police repeatedly left parking tickets on the window. And you can see the picture of the vehicle if you could see the news story. But the police made a gruesome discovery this week while getting ready to tow a heavily ticketed van, I should say. There was a decomposed body in the back seat. It was that of this missing man and this particular family member. But can you believe that? And the daughter, 58-year-old George Morales, that's the man, wants everyone to remember her handyman father in a different way, not as a decomposed body found in a van. He did have an illness. He had been dead for a month. Isn't that absolutely incredible? And finally, they call him the warden or the constable that came to tow the car in, finally looks in the back seat and sees this dead person. But isn't that absolutely incredible? Now, we've talked about, based on our show last week, we've talked about the green police and what's going on relative to that, people that don't follow standards and laws that particular communities pass. This is real life situation in London, England, and other parts of England. But here in San Francisco, they've toughened their recycling law. They have a tough one to start with, but it already boasts one of the most aggressive recycling programs of the nation. And now they've raised the ante. They're vowing to levy fines of up to $1,000 on those unwilling to separate their Kung Pao chicken leftovers from their newspapers. And what's going to happen here, you're going to get three cans, and they're all colored. Let me see if I can find that that description of these cans. And you're going to get a black one, a blue one, and a green one. The black one is for trash, the blue one is for recyclables, and the green one is for compost. And if they spot you putting orange peels in the black trash can, you're going to be in big trouble. The fine start at $100 the first time, and they can work their way up, and then for single-family homes, and then $1,000 for large businesses on the first offense. They are going to give San Franciscans 2 years, though, to get used to the ropes, to be able to tell the cans apart. So, well, I'm telling you, the city says it already composts 400 tons of food scraps a day, 90% of which goes to enriching the soil in the vineyards in Napa Valley and Sonoma, Napa and Sonoma County. So there you are. One person says people will embrace composting just like they embrace recycling, says a man named Mr. Ballard, who himself began composting kitchen scraps 6 months ago. Here in San Francisco, people are crazy about recycling. Composting is the absolute next frontier. And somebody else here in the article talks about Big Brother. And take this, this takes Big Brother to an extreme. He says that I'm not comfortable with, say, Sean Ellsburn, one or two supervisors who voted against the ordinance. So that's what they call their legislators in Barron County. Supervisor. So anyway, that's going to be interesting to see how that turns out. And then I think we'll finish with that since we have so much content to do tonight, but we've discovered a new serial killer in the city of Miami. And the serial killer is killing cats. Yes, I'm telling you, they're killing cats. And they think the police have been inundated with dozens of phone calls from people who have discovered dead cats throughout the community. They say that most of these cats are not related, cases not related to the string of cat killings, but the number officially at 15 was initially believed to be much higher. So now we've got a serial cat killer, and I haven't seen Cliff Van Sant or Pat Brown, our crime profiler, on TV yet commenting about this, but perhaps they'll bring us their expertise on serial cat killing. Of course, it's terrible. People love their cats sometimes better than they do their friends. But why in the world would somebody be interested in going around and killing cats? They're thinking possibly, this could be a gang initiation type of thing where gang members have to kill and bring in so many cats. They really don't know what the reason is. But ladies and gentlemen, we've been wanting to also pass on a tip each week after we had our second show on Going Green. And I'm going to be drawing some tips out of the wonderful book, 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet by Esme Floyd. And tonight I thought I would turn to tip number 732. This is one I must confess. Audrey, I'm sorry. Emily, I'm sorry. I know you're concerned about planet sustainability. It says here in this tip that I should choose natural fabrics to exercise in rather than highly engineered versions that require lots of energy to produce. If you have to buy the latest high-tech fabrics, make sure you buy quality so that you won't have to replace them soon and they won't have to manufacture them more. Isn't that a wonderful idea? So when I go out and look for some running shorts or shirts or even shoes, I'm going to look for something that really is one that didn't use a lot of energy in its production. And I'm sure the sales clerk will be able to answer my queries about that. There's some things over here on the other page, folks, I can't even mention, but it has to do with, I guess I could mention it. It has to do with reusable sanitary napkins. I never knew there was such a thing, but I didn't know there was reusable toilet paper either, Wally wipes. So they're recommending that you do something like that. So that's our tip that's our tip for tonight. If you're going to exercise, do clothes or buy clothes that are as natural as can be and take little energy produced. And then tip 732 says get outside and exercise. You don't have to turn on lights and exercise equipment inside. What an idea. I think the Marine Corps had that idea that you exercised outside. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's roll right over now to our story for the evening, our subject, and that's the threats and violence against news reporters all over the world. You're going to hear a organization talk about tonight, the Committee to Protect Journalists, and I want you to go to their website because it's just loaded with information. And what you're going to be stunned by is the number of journalists have been imprisoned, killed, murdered, maimed throughout the world. And this is on a rapid increase, and our commentators tonight will be explaining that. So we're going to start off with Carl Bernstein, as I said, of Watergate fame. And what we're going to do is have him tell us a little bit about what's going on in that particular area. So hold on just a second till we locate the story, and we'll tune it up here in just a second, and you'll listen to Carl Bernstein. This is actually a video, so there are going to be 3 or 4 second gaps here and there in this while you're watching nothing. You can look at something while this is going on, but it's very informative, and I think he's put his finger on something that that is just important to know relative to journalists and the danger. And, you know, the First Amendment is our First Amendment, right? So, you know, the right to a free press, in fact, the first right in the Bill of Rights ever made to apply to the states, where the states had to follow it, was the right to free speech. And so certainly relates to the press right also. So now here we go with Carl Bernstein. Give me a second here while I crank this thing up and we'll get it going. It's taking a little longer than usual, just a second. Mike, it looks like this one's not going to work. Let's go and see if the clip on Mexico will work. If that's straight audio. I think we're getting close. This is our feature part tonight anyway. We'll see if we can retrieve later on in the show if we have time for it, the Carl Bernstein introduction.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, there is a crisis in Mexican journalism stemming from threats against journalists by members of organized drug cartels. A number of Mexican journalists have been killed or disappeared as criminal drug organizations have expanded their power, and the spread of violence has increased, especially along the U.S.-Mexican border, where President Felipe Calderon has deployed nearly 50,000 troops. So how bad is it, and are the stories that need to be told being told? And is the drug violence spilling over into the United States? We'll have a panel discussion. Include your calls and emails next at the minute. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. With the government of Felipe Calderon fighting drug trafficking in Mexico, a quarter of the Mexican army is presently committed to the ongoing drug war. And the growing violence associated with criminal organizations in Mexico has made it one of the world's deadliest countries for reporters. This week, professional journalists meet at Stanford and Santa Clara universities to discuss the dangers of reporting on the increasingly violent Mexican drug trade. And in this forum, I will refocus our attention on the Mexican drug trade and the fate of journalists who work to cover it. Let me tell you who's joining us for the hour. Joel Simon is here in the studio. He's executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, a former reporter in Mexico. Good morning.
Great to be here.
Good to have you here. And Ricardo Sandoval also joins us, president of the Society for Professional Journalists, Northern California chapter, and assistant study editor of the Sacramento Bee, former foreign correspondent, Latin America, covering crime, migration, and insurgent movements. And welcome to you. Good morning.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. We also have with us by phone this morning Alfredo Corchado, who is part of the Mexican Bureau of the Dallas Morning News, currently a Nieman Fellow. He joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. And welcome, Alfredo Corchado.
Pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Dudley Althaus, who is Bureau Chief in Latin America for the Houston Chronicle, and joins us this morning from Mexico City. Welcome, Dudley Althaus.
Hola.
Hola. Buenos dias. Let me begin, actually, Joel Sherman, with you. I read the report that was put out by your organization, the Committee to Protect Journalists, and we're talking about things being so dangerous in Mexico. This is a report essentially on just how impugned he works in these different countries. Here's Mexico between, it's kind of hard for many people to grasp it, Pakistan and Bangladesh. I mean, it's that bad. It's like a war zone.
It's exactly like a war zone. And the level of violence against the press in Mexico, I mean, you have to put it in context. There's generalized violence in Mexico, but journalists are being targeted. And the numbers that we've recorded in Mexico would be typical of a war zone. And yet, Mexico obviously is not at war. So it's a very alarming situation. The result is widespread self-censorship. The result is that vital stories aren't being covered. The result is that fear is dictating the journalistic agenda in Mexico.
It is, in fact, the toughest beat right now anywhere in the hemisphere.
I think that, you know, Cuba is, you know, on a kind of a different level. Cuba is the second leading jailer of journalists, and obviously there's no free press there. But if you're talking about the rest of Latin America, you could look at Colombia. There are obviously enormous challenges there, Brazil. But Mexico, I really think at this point, is probably the most dangerous beat in all of Latin America.
What's amazing about it is, as I believe you pointed out, there be, say, gun battles in the streets and people would be killed and it wouldn't be reported.
Yeah, absolutely. There have been many such incidents of that nature. It's a kind of apocryphal tale at this point. You hear about that sort of thing in a number of different cities. Or if they are reported, it's very rudimentary. It'll be from a press release. It'll be based on one official source. But it's really reached the point in which a gun battle can take place, and people can be killed, and you won't necessarily read about that in your newspaper.
So because of all the self-censorship and because of this difficulty getting the story out and because really of the kind of control with drug cartels, you're trying to get President Obama involved and his organization?
Yeah, well, this has now become an issue which is a fundamental threat to Mexican society, and it's broader than just the press. It's about freedom of expression. It's about the ability of Mexicans to communicate with each other, to be informed about the challenges that the country faces, And essentially, the drug cartels are dictating the media agenda. They are determining what is and is not covered. And that's got to be pretty high on the agenda, certainly in Mexico, but it's part of the binational discussion.
So Mexico even behind a constitutional amendment to give federal authorities more power.
Well, what we want is the federal government needs to step in and make it a federal crime to inhibit the free exercise of free expression. It's kind of like the civil rights movement in the United States. In other words, this is a fundamental right which Mexicans are not able to exercise. The federal government must step in and take measures to ensure that people can speak freely.
Joel Sonnegan is executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists, former reporter in Mexico, and Ricardo Sandoval also with us in studio this morning. He's president of the Northern California chapter of Society of Professional Journalists, assistant city editor of the Sacramento Bee, and former correspondent in Latin America, covering crime, migration, and insurgent movements. And I suppose one of the things that has to be pointed out right away, Ricardo, is the fact that things changed when the PRI, dominant party of over nine decades, was moved out and democracy was moved in.
And that's exactly right. I think in the old days, people looked at the situation in Mexico with the relationship between the government and some of the drug cartels as the somewhat peaceful or agreeable coexistence. There's always accusations that the government was basically running the show hand in hand with the cartels, which is one of the reasons why back in the old days, it was thought that the PRI, the former ruling party, could keep a lid on things.
Well, they were bribing and corruption. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Yes. And so you remove that that lid from this boiling pot, and of course you're going to have a lot of bubbling over, which has been occurring over the last few years now.
How bad is this problem? I mean, in the sense that you talk about bubbling over, I was reading some articles out of Texas newspapers. It said the coverage here is exaggerated. It's not extreme. It's not, you know, I mean, and then you read on the other hand, the Mexican cartel, drug cartel is in 200-some American cities. I mean, how do we sort this out?
It's bad. I mean, by comparison, it's bad. In the old days, for example, you could go to Tijuana. I was born in Tijuana, so my family, I would go almost every week when I lived and was growing up in San Diego. Today, my family who lives on the border will not cross the border. They refuse to go into Tijuana. It's for the fear of being caught up as bystanders in some of this violence. Now, obviously, if you go to other cities, and even parts of larger cities like Guadalajara and Mexico City, probably you can avoid these situations. You probably won't run into this kind of stuff unless you're looking for it.
And the tourist places seem to be
by and large. Although Acapulco is a bit problematic.
What about the spillover there at the north?
The spillover, I think, you know, we are seeing an increased level of activity on this side of the border by the cartels. But I got one thing I need to say, and I feel like it's been, I'm not going to say overblown, but there has been activity by Mexican drug dealers in the United States for decades now. When I was growing up in San Diego, and I was a teenager in San Diego, I knew some kids who were being recruited to run drugs for Mexican traffickers, and they would take drugs into the American Midwest. This was in the late 70s. So it's been going on for some time. What we're seeing now is perhaps a ratcheting up of the sense of, I'm not going to say impunity, but yes, maybe impunity, or the sense that some of these dealers perhaps think they can get away with a little bit more on this side of the border.
Well, I was actually alluding to some of the spillover that was supposedly into El Paso from Juarez, and a lot of what was described in some of the Texas newspapers I was reading is media feeding frenzy and using for politics and so forth. So, like I say, sometimes it's hard to get a hold on that particular elusive topic, but it does seem profoundly scary about what's going on. In fact, you had an incident, or you had a few incidents, but you were covering killing of women in Juarez, and you had one of these goons come up to you, I guess.
Well, our friend did, and he's had that on more than one occasion. I was with him once when one of our people who helped us with the story out of Juarez indicated to us that Vicente Carrillo Fuentes was upset with the story. And he's the head of the Juarez cartel. And that gives you a little bit of a sinking feeling in your gut to know that you've upset the chief of one of the largest cartels in Mexico.
Now, we'll talk actually about that with Alfredo, but I want to also get a sense from you about just what's happening with respect to journalism. Joel Simon said a lot more self-censorship. Also, the bureaus aren't there.
And that's a strong point. We were talking before the show and realizing that of the California newspapers, for example, I can't think of a newspaper outside of the Los Angeles Times that has a full-time correspondent or set of correspondents in Mexico or Latin America in case. And that's quite a scale down from 1997 when I first went to Mexico for the San Jose Mercury News. San Diego had correspondents down there, the Mercury News, even Sacramento Bee had a correspondent down there, and the Los Angeles Times. Now it's just the Times. So you see this peeling back of the population of American journalists in Latin America. That can't be good. Eventually, it's going to have an impact. It already has, I believe, had an impact on the level of information that the public is getting in the U.S. Thank goodness that the L.A. Times and the Washington Post have made this story a priority over the last year.
So why are you optimistic? You said you're optimistic.
I'm optimistic because there is, in its place, there's this great population of young journalists who are venturing abroad now for things like the Global Post. Even as freelancers, they're venturesome. They're taking it upon themselves to go report these stories. And as the internet develops itself into a more viable source of credible, good, in-depth reporting, we're going to find more homes for this kind of reporting from abroad.
Are there a lot of reporters coming in from Colombia too, who are at least helping to some extent to get at the story? They've certainly been better than these drug stories.
Yeah, and the great thing about that is that there's a great level of in English interchange or intercambio, you say in Spanish, but we're able to help each other out a lot more these days.
Carlos Sandoval, again, former foreign correspondent in Latin America, who covered crime, migration, and insurgent movement, or did now with the Sacramento Bee as assistant city editor. Well, Alfredo Cachado, let's bring you into this, and Alfredo Cachado is with the Mexican Bureau of the Dallas Morning News, but now in Cambridge as a Nieman Fellow, a native of Mexico. That story about that guy saying to you, what, the FBI can't protect everybody? And tell us about it.
Well, that incident actually happened in Laredo, of all places, which I think was, to me, the biggest surprise because it happened on the U.S. side. And so what happened there was I was covering the movement of the paramilitary group known as the FETAs, who are the armed forces of the cartel in the state of San Luis, known as the GOP cartel. And I was, I'd been covering them that same day. I was, I had done a couple of interviews with a couple of U.S. sources. And that evening, as I'm sitting at a bar in Laredo, Texas, I get the short version of the story. This guy comes up to me and essentially hands me over to Cuba and says, you know, it's great that you're here. It's great that, you know, people are still coming in to Laredo. As you can see, it's a peaceful city. We have beautiful women. We have beautiful atmosphere, blah, blah, blah. The problem is when people start asking too many questions, like who are the festivals, how do they operate, who are they killing, et cetera. And then he went into great detail. It's funny what would happen to me if I didn't stop doing that.
Was this also kind of, he put his arm around you and was reacting real palpy, smiling?
Yeah, I put his arm around me. My first reaction when he came over and was very positive about Laredo was I thought he was from the Chamber of Commerce there. when he started describing El Perro and pouring, you know, acid over me and videotaping the incident to send it back to my parents in Texas, that's when I knew this was a message.
Yeah, in fact, I think you said that it was a young kid who had an acid injected into his heart. This is, not to get too graphic here, but from your perspective, this is like when the cartel started crossing the Rubicon, when they became, no more. It's like, you know, Costa Nostra used to have certain rules. You know, you didn't kill members of the family and all that sort of thing, and then they started violating those rules, that kind of thing.
Right, and that's kind of when we started seeing a new kind of violence in Mexico. You know, the barrels, the acid, the beheadings, et cetera. it was a, I guess it was, you know, it was a new reality for the press and also for the people who live there in Mexico.
There was a terrible incident recently in Alabama, and they tied it to a Mexican drug cartel. I mean, there was obviously a warning because there was some puncturing of all kinds of organs and slashing, and again, one doesn't want to get into too graphic detail here, but it's pretty horrible. And a lot of this, I think, as you pointed out, Alfredo, sort of stems from special forces training. I mean, a lot of these guys are trained by the military initially, aren't they?
Well, there was a small group of soldiers, Mexican soldiers, who were trained back in the 90s by the military. U.S. military, they were known as the GAFES. They went back to Mexico, and the goal was to take on cartels to be the enforcers. The way the story goes, the head of the GAFES cartel went up to some of the members and said, how much are you getting paid? He quoted him a price, says, I'll double it or triple it. Top will give you a certain percentage of the distribution route. And lo and behold, 35 members took up the offer and thus became the group known as the Fetas.
And from your perspective, there's this old notion that if you're an American journalist, you're less likely to have violence visited upon you, or to put it in the everyday terms, get whacked. But you and Ricardo, being brown-skinned and being of Mexican descent, sort of fall into a different category, do you?
Well, I didn't think that. I always thought that, you know, being an American allowed me certain privileges or certain protections. And it was really probably organized crime in Mexico that, I guess, you know, woke me up, if you will. I was, after the second or third threat, the paper sent me to a training program at the State Department in Washington. And it was interesting that most of the people who were there were on their way to the fact that I think, my colleague, Angela Pacheco, was the only journalist from Mexico. After 3 days of training. After the training, I went up to talk to one of my sources, and I said, no, I think I feel good about this. I'm ready to go back to Mexico. I'm ready to go back to the story. And after a while, the guy says, you know, I have good news and bad news for you. Good news is, yes, you're an American journalist. No one wants to wrestle with an American journalist because it's a 30 to $40 billion industry, and that it'll disrupt that. You know, that's the business. Bad news, you don't look American. So I was asked to, you know, recommend that I wear all my credentials outside and, you know, make sure I tell everybody I'm an American journalist.
So wrap yourself in the stars and stripes or something like that.
Short of walking around with
exactly.
A flag.
Yeah, walking around with a flag around you. Alfredo Crochado, again, is with us this morning from Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he's currently a Nieman Fellow. He is with the Mexican Bureau for the Dallas Morning News and a native of Mexico. Dudley Althaus is Bureau Chief in Latin America for the Houston Chronicle. He joins us this morning from Mexico City. And talking, Dudley Althaus, about all of this self-censorship and all the problems that accrue for journalists down there. But you've said that some of the big national papers in Mexico City are doing a good job, and Proceso, the left-leaning magazine, has done a good job on this.
Yeah, I think they have. I think there is a lot of information getting out. What happens a lot in the provinces is smaller papers that are actually operating or being published in the towns where these guys are, have done a lot of self-censorship in the sense that you don't read names of who's behind certain killings or that sort of thing. They don't get into too many details, which I think is very dangerous. But the national press, I think, has done a fairly good job. I rely on them. It's a big country. And Proceso, I think, has done a very good job.
It's dangerous for foreign journalists, though. I mean, as much as it is for Mexican journalists. I know you wanted to do a story in Dorado about a local political boss tied to a cartel, and you felt some apprehension and hesitation, to put it mildly.
Yeah, I think if you're around a lot, Alfredo has been covering the border very intensely, and I think he's there a lot, and they got to know him much better. I think for a national, like a roving correspondent here, somebody that pops in and pops out, it's less dangerous, but it has had a chilling effect. You think twice or three times about going into, especially rural towns, to do a story on, say, a local local political boss or a local who might be a drug dealer. I was just in Durango, and there is a chilling effect. In Durango, it doesn't get reported much, but there's been an enormous amount of kidnappings and disappearances of people. And so you think two or three times before going into some of those villages because the guys are there.
What about just not using your byline?
You know, people do that. The Mexican press has started doing that. I don't see where that's really a protection, especially for local newspapers. Pretty much everybody knows who's writing the story anyhow. You know, the sources know who just called them. I suppose it gives some sort of a near of a protection, but it seems to me like the old the dye they used to give the aviators in World War II who had to ditch in the ocean for anti-shark dye or something, which didn't work at all. It's just more like a security blanket, I think. But I think for local journalists, if you're reporting on this stuff, for local Mexican journalists, I think you're in danger anyhow. I think the fact that they're still reporting on this, especially in the provincial papers, really suggests the level of bravery of some of these reporters.
Yeah, no, an immense amount of courage. I would second that or echo that. Yet a lot of these stories that aren't being covered, nevertheless, are seeping out. Stories about smuggling of guns into Mexico, stories about drugs going across the border one way or the other. I think you kind of summed it up in a way that seems to make a good deal of sense, that Mexico isn't so much a failed state. What we have is a failed justice law and order system.
It's an extremely failed law and order system. I mean, they are. To me, this is the biggest test of Mexico's post-one-party system. It's a multi-party system that's working towards a full democracy. This is a huge test for that. You have all kinds of different and competing powers between local, state, and federal governments that didn't exist before. They just kind of like worked through those. It's always been in the Constitution, the separation of powers, but when Mexico was a one-party system, that was just kind of like, you know, the formal system and everything else was worked out through the party bureaucracy. And now you have competing powers, and in a lot of cases just, it falls through the cracks in a lot of the justice, and it gives a lot of people cover for passing the buck. So, yeah, the system, I think, is extremely vulnerable, and that's really affecting people here.
Is there a sense that President Calderon is really making much headway with this? I mean, like I said earlier on, he's got 50,000 troops mobilized at the border. I mean, he's got an immense amount of what exists in the military there out fighting this drug war, about a third, in fact, of the military.
Well, to me, where the troops are and where the federal police have really cracked down, say, like in Juarez at the moment, I mean, they have almost a full division worth of federal police and army troops in Juarez, a city of 1 million people. 1.3 million, it's under army occupation. And the crime, the murders have gone way down. There's still a large number of murders in the city, despite all the troops. But the troops can't be everywhere. I did a story about a month ago in Durango again, where some very small villages actually had built moats around the village to protect themselves from rampaging bands that were coming in to kidnap. Now, these are rural farm villages. The moats didn't work, but the villagers were told by the army to build the moats because the army couldn't be there.
We're coming up on a break here, so let me give out the phone number. Let me just say, you know, that with the recession, the number of undocumented coming over the border has decreased, but there are people who are coming over the border just because they need to feel safe. I mean, things are pretty bad. And we want to hear from you. If you'd like to join this conversation, we welcome your involvement. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786, whether you're listening on radio, Internet, or SiriusXM satellite. Feel free to join the program, 866-733-6786, or send an email for kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This week, professional journalists are meeting at Stanford and Santa Clara University to talk about the dangers of reporting on the drug trade in Mexico, which is what we're talking about in this hour. Journalists are under fire, self-censoring, and the concern for physical safety and the intensity of the violence associated with the drug cartel in Mexico has simply escalated, and escalated to a point where it's gotten really out of control. We were talking off air about the fact that even in the Ricardo Sandoval was saying in the local areas, the police authorities don't have the authority and they don't really have the resources. And Joel Fannin was saying when you send in the troops, you know, you get the kind of thing that you see here in the United States. military trying to act like police, and often that presents real difficulties as well. So we are going to go to your calls here. I want to just remind those of you who are interested in the events that I alluded to at Stanford and Santa Clara. It's 6 p.m. Tomorrow evening, April 23rd, at Santa Clara University, and 1 p.m. Friday on the 24th of April at Stanford University. And let me remind you that we're talking by phone to Alfredo Corchado, who is with the Mexican Bureau of the Dallas Morning News, joining us this morning from Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he is currently a NEMA fellow. He's native of Mexico. And also with us by phone this morning from Mexico City, Dudley Althaus, who is Bureau Chief in Latin America for the Houston Chronicle. Our guest in the studio, Alessandro Sandoval, President of the Society of Professional Journalists, for the California chapter, and assistant city editor of the Sacramento Bee, former foreign correspondent in Latin America, and Bill Simon, Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. By the way, let me give out their website. That is the Society for Professional Journalists. If you want more information about this, you can simply go to SPJ NorCal, that is Northern California chapter that Ricardo Sandoval is president of. And it's spjnorcal.org. And we are going to go to your calls. Let me go to our first caller, Jorge. Good morning.
How you doing? Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I've listened to you the past few days, and by now we all already know that Mexico is a major drug, producing and transitory country, and is the main foreign supplier of marijuana and methamphetamine to the United States. We know of the violence, and one of the things I would like to ask you, panelists, because we're talking about journalists about issues that are going in Mexico. Recently, I read a report on the LA Times about a journalist coming to the United States and asking for political asylum. He was claiming that he was being persecuted by the Mexican army. And the State Department was afraid that this was going to become a widespread problem of Mexicans asking for political asylum in massive numbers because of the violence in Mexico. So I would like to comment on that. And one more thing I would like to say about the violence in Mexico, something that seemed to not be reported, is that the fact that the government is taking off so many heads of cartels is creating a power vacuum within these cartels, and the violence is really between them and not necessarily the cartels against, civilians or the government.
It increases the competition. Sorry, thank you for that call. Let me ask Joe Simon, you know the case of
Silent Yeah, I think this is the case of Emilio Gutierrez, who's a journalist who was reporting in Juarez. His house was raided by the Mexican military. He, fearing for his life, went to the United States and asked for asylum, and his asylum is being processed. This is the threats and the notion of crossing the border and trying to escape some of the pressure that is happening. Political asylum is very, very unusual.
Well, I think you get the idea. I'm sorry Carl Bernstein took off early tonight, but he only had about a four-minute introduction to this this whole thing to start with. But let's pay tribute where it should be paid. I mean, these journalists have had some courage to go down and cover this drug news, and some of them have been drug cartel news, and some have been covering these circumstances for a number of years. And it's certainly natural that they would they would experience some fear about what they're doing, journalists on both sides of the border. But it takes a lot of courage to get involved in something like it. It takes a lot of courage to be a crime reporter, for that matter. The old idea of a crime reporter per se is probably gone in virtually all newspapers in the United States. But we do have people that cover that. But this border, this whole thing goes back to the border to start with. I mean, if you have a border that's seems to be as porous as ours is. I don't know what we're ever going to do. The news tonight has been about the last 2 days about some great big tunnel that they found, the nicest tunnels, one Border Patrol agent said, that he's ever seen. Well, if we can't find these things and put a stop to them, then we're going to have a trouble anyway. Well, anyway, that's our show for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. And we hope you tune in next week for another show. Look at the Blog Talk Radio, Jumbo Justice Radio site to see what we'll be doing next week, and I'm sure we'll be meeting again. We
again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long, they'll be happy.